Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi there, and welcome again to the Explaining History podcast. And today I want to look generally at some of the roots of 20th century fascism. Today we're going to be looking at Fascism, a History by Roger Eatwell. It's really a kind of a classic of the study of fascism as an intellectual tradition. And one of the points that Roger Eatwell makes first off in the book is that a common misconception about fascism as opposed to Marxism or liberalism or conservatism is that in the case of those three ideologies and any other major world ideology you care to think of, there are significant figures, significant thinkers, founding intellectuals, if you will, Marx, Burke, those sorts of characters. John Stuart Mill for liberalism, and it's assumed that there are no comparative figures in fascist thinking. This is not true. It's also assumed that fascist thinking doesn't really conform to ideological structures, that it is more a cult of emotion than one of thought. Again, arguably not true. The thing when you're examining such a thing from the perspective of intellectual history is to assume that there is a kind of a concomitant level of intellectualism, that any set of ideas must be deep, profound, coherent, and have a kind of a robust logic. Well, again, that's not necessarily the case. Some of the kind of the wilder contradictions of fascism were the product of ideas. Ideas believed probably by most rational individuals living in open democratic civil society to be irrational, but they are ideas nonetheless. And I think that the important challenge when looking at fascism is looking at not the Hitlers, not the Mussolinis, but the everyday fascists, people for whom historical events had made these extreme positions seem entirely credible, logical even, and actually a way out of the problems that they faced. That's the challenge, really, and that's what we're going to try to fathom in a series of several podcasts that I want to do on the nature of fascism. One of our difficulties now is that the term fascism has been so overused, as it means almost nothing. Virtually anyone can be accused of it, whether that's a realistic and a valid statement or not. There are those who are perhaps on the edges of fascist ideas, who could be more aptly described as kind of extreme reactionary conservatives. There are those who are simply the proponents of free market economics, who are enthusiasts for kind of neoliberalism's wars. Again, arguably not fascists at all. It doesn't necessarily make what they believe any more palatable. And then there are those who, the kind of the conflation with fascism and statism, where basically any figure on the left that approves of expansions in nationalisation or the welfare state can also be accused of being fascist. And again, this is a kind of a nonsense, and it's a kind of a convenient sort of alt-right trope that gets bandied around on a regular basis if you ever have the misfortune to read some of this stuff on YouTube. One of Hitler's stated aims was that he would overthrow the French Revolution, that he would mean to undo it. He put this in Mein Kampf, and his reasoning here was that the French Revolution was the end product of that period in history we thought, I think it was the Enlightenment. The Enlightenment being the kind of the beginnings of modernity and the beginnings of philosophies surrounding the individual. It was the beginnings of liberal thought, where individuals such as Rousseau argued that the extent of the state should be limited, that individual freedoms were far more important than any other consideration, and that there should be the political and social structures present in society that preserved individual liberty. From this, from the French Revolution and from Britain's Industrial Revolution, the dual revolution that Hobsbawm talks about in The Age of Revolution, grew the 19th century bourgeoisie, those who had done very well out of the expansion of political liberty across Europe, and also the those who did very well out of the development of kind of economic liberty. The idea that the state was essentially meant to be a laissez-faire entity. It was not meant to become involved overly in the operation of society, that taxes were meant to be low, regulations were meant to be light, and that the 19th century bourgeoisie, the capitalists, the owners of capital, could do much as they pleased, with terrible social consequences as a result, giving rise to a trade union movement and eventually socialist parties by the later years of the 19th century. This, of course, was an anathema to the likes of Hitler. The fascists who emerged after the First World War, some kind of slightly beforehand, but mainly after the First World War, were often united in looking back at the previous several centuries and asking themselves essentially where everything had gone so wrong, where ideas that were conducive to national weakness as they saw it had emerged from, in Germany, in Italy, and in other states where fascism and right-wing authoritarianism emerge after the First World War. They are either the vanquished states, the defeated states, or the revanchist states. Countries like Italy and Japan that don't feel that they have got their fair share of the spoils out of the Treaty of Versailles. Fascism becomes a rejection of Enlightenment values. It becomes a rejection of modernity. And the fascists position themselves as kind of counter-revolutionaries against the products of modernity, against liberalism and socialism, partly because both ideologies presented a common theory of humanity, a sense of equality, and a belief that solidarity between human beings transcended national, racial, or religious boundaries. Fascists believed that identity could only be sought through the race or the tribe. And by the late 19th century, of course, racial thinking from eugenics, the eugenicist movement, which had co-opted and kind of bastardized Darwin's works, is injected into this. This is where many of the ideas that Hitler later latches onto emerge from a kind of a deep vein of European racial thinking in the late 19th century. Fascists were normally better at articulating what they opposed than what they stood for, what they rejected, what they saw as the kind of the sins of mass society. The belief that creative destruction was an integral part of any fascist project seems to be there through a whole range of different fascist thinkers, beginning principally with Gabriel D'Annunzio in 1919. D'Annunzio argued that the weak and corrupt parliamentary democracy in Italy needed to be purged through violence. It needed to be, the existing order needed to be kind of overthrown, and a simple mass-based form of politics would replace it. One that, and here is where the romanticism of fascism comes in, one that would simply articulate this will of the people, that any political representatives were merely part of a kind of a plebiscitary democracy, or not even a democracy at all. They were there simply to articulate this almost kind of inarticulable idea of the people's will. Of course, if you're a demagogue, of course you're a populist, of course you're a fascist, the people's will can be what it suits you for it to be. Speaking of romanticism, here's what Roger Eatwell has to say about it. The romantic movement emerged during the 18th century, largely as a response to the hyper-rationalism of the Enlightenment, and reached its high point with the works of German writers such as Johann von Goethe and Friedrich von Schelling. Among its many aspects were the worship of nature, the glorification of the national against the universal and the timeless, and the exaltation of genius over the mediocrity of the masses. The last aspect was sometimes specifically artistic, the tortured creative soul unappreciated by bourgeois society. Now, if there isn't a better description of how Hitler saw himself in the early years, I'd like to hear it. But it could also take on a political form in the quest for the strong leader who could lead a national rebirth. Similar diffuse hostility towards material values became increasingly translated during the late 19th century into political anti-Semitism. The Jew was pilloried as the epitome of capitalist materialism, a view particularly prevalent in the German Volkisch movement, which railed against the evils of urban industrial society. So there's a lot to unpack there, but there is this very interesting and complicated relationship between Romanticism and fascism. Romanticism is this metaphysical notion. It is something that exists in the realm of thought, feeling and sentiment, not rationality, logic and science. It is where kind of belief transcends and trumps all else. And one of the key features of the current wave of right-wing populism that we can see spreading across the world at the moment, and in some cases out-and-out fascism, is the idea of belief. If we simply all believe in the countries that we live in a little bit harder and we're a bit more passionate about it all, somehow something good will come of all of this.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive and June. Olive and June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
And this kind of irrationality, it has its roots in the Romantic period, which of course was this reaction to universalism and individualism and rationality and science and modernity that emerge from the Enlightenment. Why does this happen? Well, because during the Romantic period, people sought out new forms of self-expression, self-identification, as human beings always will do. There's a clear connection between nationalist and fascist thoughts, but that's not to suggest that all nationalists are fascists, but probably all fascists have nationalist ideas. In the beginnings in the early 19th century, nationalism had a decidedly liberal kind of outlook. During 1848, liberals and nationalists across Europe sought to establish states and they sought to overthrow transnational empires like the Habsburg Empire in order to establish liberal constitutions. If you can create your own German state, you can create a liberal constitution in which the state, with all its power of army and police, can actually protect individual rights as opposed to suppress them. So the nation was, as far as the liberal nationalists were concerned, meant to be the framework into which you inject liberalism. The failure of 1848, as Bismarck pointed out, was due to the absence of blood and iron. And Bismarck, who'd been very suspicious of nationalism as an idea, actually saw an opportunity to co-opt it, to seize nationalism, and to bend it for reactionary purposes. Nationalism during the late 19th century shifts towards the right. Roger Eatwell writes, one of the high priests of this new nationalism was the French journalist and writer Maurice Barrès, who became the prophet of rootedness in Racimont, involving a mystical social union between the living and the dead. Whereas early nationalism had been closely associated with modernity, this new form was highly critical of what it saw as the resulting divisive materialism. Barrès believed that the epitaph of the French had become born a man, died a grocer, whereas the old nationalism was essentially concerned with legitimising the overthrow of regimes. This form of nationalism was obsessed with the need to secure social unity in order to prevent the collapse of states and to develop the martial values necessary to survive in war. By the 1890s, Barrès was talking of national socialism, though the term was essentially manipulative, for his social views were more conservative than radical. So here we've got some more fascinating stuff to unpack here. The idea of rootedness, the idea of this mystical union between the living and the dead, between the present and the past. Fascism has to feed upon its past, the idea of the story that fascism invariably tells of there having been once a glorious past, but things having gone now terribly wrong, normally due to somebody like the Jews or socialists or some other kind of troublemaker ruining it for everybody and causing a once mighty nation, be it Italy or France or Britain or Germany, to now be ruined and brought low. This new authoritarian nationalism that was part of the means by which leaders throughout the 19th century bolstered the support for the nation states that they had created, which had sprung up across Europe, and that was geared towards ever more kind of aggressive and assertive manifestations of itself, as we can see from the kind of the jingoism and the militarism of the late 19th century. It, of course, if you combine it with European imperialism and to some degree American imperialism in the very late 19th and 20th century, is, of course, the kind of the crucible from where modern racism springs. Obviously, the argument of the kind of the roots of kind of modern racism go far further back, all the way back to the Atlantic slave trade and slightly beyond that. But the late 19th century sees the emergence of a kind of a particular kind of racial thinking, equal rights. This holistic nationalism was highly critical of liberal universalism, a feature which contributed to the rise of a new racism. Hostility to outsiders had existed since prehistoric times, and ancient Greek philosophy had demonised the barbarian other. What emerged during the late 19th century was a more systematic form of racial thinking. Two names stand out in this development: the French aristocrat Arthur de Gobineau and the Englishman Houston Stuart Chamberlain, who in later life adopted German citizenship and became an admirer of the rising young politician named Adolf Hitler. Gobineau's key work was his essay on the inequality of human races, written in the 1850s, but little read until after the 1870s. He saw the world as polarised between white, yellow and black races, and argued that the motor of history was the struggle between these races. Chamberlain was deeply influenced by the nationalism of the composer Richard Wagner, who became his father-in-law. His Foundations of the 19th Century, published in 1900, was widely read, or more precisely, sold and talked about. Its seminal importance to the emergence of fascism, however, lies in more than just its influence. It is also related to its style. For Chamberlain's arguments were not simply based on Wagnerian historical or mystical notions. He synthesised these ideas with a growing body of scientific and intellectual developments and rejected the pessimism of Gobineau. It's interesting that within a few years of the writing of the Communist Manifesto, which sets out initially that all history is the history of class struggle, that Gobineau's first pronouncements in the 1850s was really that all history is the history of racial struggle. These were the ideas that Hitler adhered to in Mein Kampf. This is the core operating feature of Hitler's thought, that all history really is the history of racial struggle, and that racial struggle defines all aspects of the material world, or of the universe, if you like, and that the purpose of being is to be part of a race that is involved in a constant struggle for resources with others, and that the victors, the worthy in human history, in human experience, are the martial races that can crush others. The current sort of alt-right trope that national socialism means that the Nazis and therefore Hitler were socialists is a nonsense, really, because of this one central idea that Hitler, whilst using the term national socialism, was a racial thinker. He's not really interested in anything else. In fact, as far as Marxism went, he writes in Mein Kampf that the problem with democracy is that if you allow enough of it, you'll wind up with Marxism, i.e. you'll wind up with people sharing, voting to share society's resources equally. So he was certainly, there's no evidence of any socialist thinking from Hitler. So three key ingredients we can identify here: Romanticism, a rejection of the Enlightenment, a rejection of modernity, a rejection of rationalism for sentiment and emotion; nationalism, a belief in the nation, a belief in the tribe; and racialism, the kind of pseudo-scientific idea that there is a taxonomy of races, that there are good, better and master races, and that the purpose of history is to engage in racial struggle. These are the three ingredients that create fascism. And at the heart of the kind of romanticist thinking was the notion of the great leader. The question that many fascist thinkers had in the late 19th century was that in an age defined by mass politics and socialism and mass trade unions, where what was the future for the individual? And because they concluded that the liberal future for the individual, where all individual rights were entirely valid and respected, that wasn't viable either, or desirable. So, as far as the future for the individual went, fascists in the late 1930s, 20th century concluded the only individual that mattered is the leader. There was the charismatic, inspired leader. Again, a romantic notion of the kind of the hero who could, through will and charisma and some sort of special knowledge, some special insight on the nature of the people, be able to bring about miraculous transformations in the nation simply by ordering it. These are the kind of the fantasies that the likes of Hitler and Mussolini fed about themselves, and that the, as far as other individuals went, there were none. There were simply the leader and the followers. Again, this is a kind of a highly romantic notion. It's almost like a kind of Rousseauian notion, one that was in some parts the origin of Enlightenment thought. One of the great paradoxes of the Enlightenment is it kind of does leave, dotted around the intellectual landscape of Europe and the New World, the component parts of fascist thinking. Now we're going to continue, as I've said, in the next few weeks with some other kind of dips into the origins of fascism. But I hope this is useful and helps to kind of start to kind of disentangle this really complicated terminology and ideology. Anyway, thanks very much for listening, and I'll catch you on the next Explaining History podcast. All the best. Thanks. Bye-bye.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Swimsuit? Check. Sunscreen? Check. Phone charger? Check. Don't forget to pack the 5-Hour Energy. It fits great in a pocket or carry-on, and the alert feeling will help you arrive ready for anything. Now get 20% off when you use code 5HETRAVEL at 5HourEnergy.com. Expires April 30th. One-time use only. Not valid with other discounts. Remember, visit 5HourEnergy.com and use code 5HETRAVEL to save 20%.